Welcome to episode 59 of the Champagne Comedy Podcast, where we talk about the best Australian comedy show from the 90s ever made, Frontline, and other D-Generation comedy tidbits. My name is Matt, and joining this podcast today is Alison, Daniel, and Kim.
Hey!
Hey!
Welcome back, Kim.
We're back to do it again.
Yes. And we won't hold back any further. We've got another special guest for this podcast. My check managed to clear, so thank you very much for coming on. This person is a major fan of the D-Gen Late Show, as we all are, and is also a major cricket sports nut, and some other little tidbits as well, which we'll reveal later on. But we have Dom on the show.
Yes. Audience isn't quite loud enough, but I'll accept it. You know what? That money I paid you was the best 12.5 cents I've ever spent.
All right?
Hooray! Best 12.5 cents I've ever spent. Oh, lovely to be here. Thanks so much for welcoming me in.
Excellent. You like to share some really nice little golden nuggets of cricket yesteryear and TV yesteryear as well.
I do. The problem with me is that I've got a ridiculously... The biggest part of me is the nostalgic part of me, and it's almost sickening how nostalgic I can be sometimes and how much I long for the wildly un-PC days of television and cricket. But I've got what I find on VHS on YouTube, which is plainly a bunch of ad breaks all tacked together into one segment. And it's a little ironic that we now fast forward the movie to get to the ads on those tapes these days. It used to be the other way around. I don't give a shit about the movies anymore, you know. But it's the same with the cricket. It's the same era and it's the same adoration I have for it. And, yeah, it all goes up on Twitter on Cup Mutual.
One other nostalgic moment, which has also made a comeback recently, you're a particular fan of a certain band. Well, you're a mastermind, so to speak.
Well, that's a misnomer, actually. And the reason is because, yes, I did go on Mastermind with my specialist subject is TISM, but I also finished fourth.
Oh.
So... that's my yin and yang of the story of my life, really.
Just like the band still... would want you to finish as well, I'm sure.
Yeah, good point. That's a good point. But I say that I get steamed about watching Mastermind these days only because I finish last, and the score I finish last on wins just about every other episode I've ever seen.
Oh.
So that really steams me, you know.
Oh, wow, that is rubbing it in, wow.
You followed through with TISM, so TISM is shit, you were shit, so it's a win-win.
Who the fuck isn't? Exactly. Yeah. It makes perfect sense.
When you on Mastermind to cover TISM, did you come disguised so that no one knew your identity? Because that would have been very much...
I was already anonymous. Okay. It didn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. Hang on a sec. Are you in TISM there, Dom? Yeah.
No. That's what they'd say though, right?
Yeah. No.
I don't like the length of the pause it took. I don't know if it might have been the internet.
It was a delay. It was nothing to do with the pause. It was a delay.
So just explain to me in 25 words all this. Go.
This wasn't one of the questions. That sounded like a statement. Anyway.
It should have been one of the questions.
Band from the 80s, famous in the 90s, useless in the 2000s, and even worse in the 2010-20s. Is that all right?
That's perfect.
Pretty good. I think they're a 7-piece band. They're all anonymous. They all use humorous pseudonyms.
That's right. I don't know how many of them are broadcastable.
Hitler Barassi is the one I remember.
And the thing is, everyone says that they're totally anonymous and they've always been had their faces covered while they play gigs. But I think on Music Jamboree, John Safran's show, they were all named in the credits because they had the writing credits for Old Man River and all their real names appeared on the screen. And it was almost like it was some sort of accident. It was like, Hitler Barassi didn't write this song. It was Eugene Sester or something. It was the uncle of the kids from Jet.
Hold on, I'm going to go get the DVD. Yeah,
here's the DVD. Okay.
So you might have to cross-reference that. There it is.
Alison beat me.
It's definitely on the rolling credits on the TV. I'm not sure if it's in the liners, though.
Tism are listed there, right? But obviously there's nothing really on the cover. So I'm going to have to watch it now, the episode with Tism.
Yes, I'm pretty sure all the names are actually identified in the credits.
There's a booklet. It's not in the booklet.
That's the one. I think you could cut out a few things, like, because I've got the DVD as well. From memory, I think they've got like a cutout 50-cent side that you could paste onto an actual 50-cent coin to try and commemorate the Fairlight synthesizer.
Yes, that's right. And there's a McDonald's Snog and Win. Match the David Thrussels and win of a coma card. In the event that I may pass into a coma for some unexpected reason, please wake me with this song.
Yeah, I chose Nickelback for all that stuff because I want something that I don't like, and that will go, all right, you got me up, turn it off.
That's a good question to ask around the table, actually, if you're comatose.
One for me which would really get me up and going would probably be Vitriol by Blue Juice, I think.
Radio.
Good luck and don't dare give up. Give it a little bit of vitriol.
Like I should say five more in a row or something like that, but probably what I would actually prefer to wake up to is maybe Underground by Ben Folds 5, and I'm showing my age there, but hey, I'm from the 90s, man.
We're all from the 90s, aren't we?
Yeah, we're all from the 90s.
We are.
No shame in it.
Yeah.
Yes. My specialist subject was Tism. That says all that needs to be said.
But which one? Which Tism?
The one with the purple sneakers out of Thunderbirds are coming out.
That's the one, yes.
Yeah.
The one that was actually unmasked in the video and no one ever saw it.
If you've seen the music clip, you'll know exactly what we're talking about. But I'll also segue into a Champagne Comedy connection with Tism, right?
Yeah.
Not this podcast. I'm talking about the Late Show DGen. You've obviously seen the clip from the ARIE Awards in 95, where they team up, or they're doing performing Greg the Stop Sign in the elevator with Tony Martin, Mick Malloy.
And a fleeting appearance from Meryl Bainbridge as well.
Yeah, and Richard Stubbs with the bomber jacket.
Like it's
FM styling.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's quite interesting that, they're a band which, I mean, well, the actual acronym is This Is Serious Mum, and yet they're very unserious at the same time. They also have a lot of connections with comedy in general. I'm pretty sure there was footage I saw of Tism performing in front of, it might have been a debate or an auction or something that's being done by Brian Nankervis.
We'll go with that. That's something that they would do.
And then, later on there's been sort of the association between Damien Cowell and Tony Martin.
Yeah, well, they worked together.
More recently.
Speaking of Tony Martin, I could have sworn that during one of the Tism Home videos released on the White Album DVD, there was an intro made by Tony Martin impersonating John Howard, and he gets on this vitriolic swearing rant. And only hear it in the background. You can't actually hear it clearly, but it sounds exactly like Tony Martin's John Howard impression. And I think he may have recorded stuff for them for a gig without putting it to record.
And to sort of bring it back to our subject matter, they've actually name-checked Frontline in a song.
Yes, they did. What's the title of that song?
Oh, okay. Here we go. This is going to earn our explicit rating on the podcast apps.
Yeah, I'll go get someone else to say it because as a guest, I don't want to say
it. Can we put in the Mastermind music just before Daniel answers the question? What's the song?
I might be a cunt, but I'm not a fucking cunt. And the specific line in question is, I might watch A Current Affair, but I watch Frontline also.
Fantastic.
So there you go.
We've drawn as many parallels as we possibly can.
There's plenty more where that came
there'll
from.
There'll be more.
Yeah. So enough with the sparkling repartee, and let's get into and I'll make this one a quick one. That Cheap Seats are coming back April 30.
Good.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, just saw that advertised. And that means, have you been paying attention shortly after usually?
Usually in May, yeah.
Good times, everyone. It's been pretty lean for people who like Australian comedy in the past few months on television anyway.
Yeah. How do you get a hold of it, Alison, when you're over there? Do you watch it
every
week?
Oh, I won't reveal my methods, but, you know, anyone with a rudimentary knowledge of such things will know what my methods are.
Yeah, you manage.
I get by very well.
There's only so much you can re-watch Darradong City Council.
The idea that I even watched more than one episode of that.
Oh, you're special.
Well, I mean, obviously it's kind of ludicrous that I watched the first one, because I really should have just destroyed all copies that I had at that point. But destroy the master tapes.
Yes.
Anyway.
Yeah, if only that we gave that warning to Daryl Summers years ago. And I believe, Daniel, you got some news.
Yeah, and it's got to do with the castle. We probably should have seen this coming because we had Wenli Ma put the castle in at number 14 on her top 50 Australian movies list for The Nightly. And she mentioned that the castle was increasingly a wish fulfillment fantasy in 2024. We also had an anniversary. It's been 27 years since The Castle was released. That milestone passed this past week. Basically, there was a bit of talk about it on social media. According to Joshua Haig, who wrote this for news.com.au, some modern-day viewers are claiming the influence this film has had on certain parts of Aussie culture has been less than positive. A row has broken out on social media this week, with numerous viewers claiming the film has done major damage to urban planning in Australia since its release almost three decades ago. "The film that did irreparable damage to urban planning in Australia," claimed a fan on Twitter. "A converge towards self-entitlement and hypocrisy, a surrender to urban sprawl and sitting on a motorway 2 hours a day," they continued. I haven't even looked up to see if these things are genuine. I mean, the headline is "Aussie Movie Classic Slammed Online," but it's this sort of thing where you can't really tell whether it's actually gone viral or not. Like, it's only about a handful of tweets that have been mentioned. And another person agreed to the original tweet, replying, "I have a theory which is more based off my hazy memories of 2000s-ish television than anything. After The Castle, Michael was the host of Hot Property, which I suspect played a large part in kicking off the property bubble." While another pondered, "Literally when the housing boom took off. Coincidence?" However, not everyone agreed with the complaints, and many fans of the classic film rushed to defend it. "I'm in flames over this, one of my favourite movies of all time. I'll be thinking about this tweet late at night when I can't sleep," ranted one user. "Do you look at everything through the same insufferable, joyless lens?" hit back another.
It's good to know that people on Twitter aren't easily offended.
I am confused about what they're actually arguing about, because how has urban planning been affected by the castle? Are people just walking into council offices and going, "It's the vibes, it's the vibe of the thing," right? And
I think it's the same problem with Cyrus Persian carpets. After Aladdin was screened, there was a big problem with cheap rugs everywhere. It was just a nightmare.
But they're almost closing down.
Yeah, there's a...
They're closing down. They're open for 1 week only.
Yeah.
Not closing down, open for one more week only.
So because of all this supposed brouhaha plus the anniversary of the castle, the Today Show on Channel 9 decided to get Michael Caton onto the show via video link. Basically, the interview was quite short, and it had more to do with Michael's wife, Helen. Could be heard constantly in the background. Now, the clip I've got here, to be honest, there's not a lot of Michael in it, but it might explain why the interview was quite short, with Helen putting in, dare I say, a cheap seats-worthy performance.
"Some people online are saying the film did damage the urban planning in Australia. So how would you respond to that?"
"Wow.
That's fun. Oh, my goodness.
That's the castle too."
"Oh, my God, the Working Dog Boys have their sequel right in your home, Michael Caton, truly."
"Oh, my God.
I know, my wife." Can we get your wife in?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Oh, we need.
What a gem she is. You're lucky. You're a lucky man, Michael.
Oh, that's so good.
Sorry.
All right. Well, that just worked its way into folklore of a different kind. Well, in the castle too. I'm glad we're part of it. Hey, you're a legend, Michael. Thanks for being with us. We love your smiling face. Look at her. She's a gem.
Yes.
A cup full of kooky, and that's what we love here on the Today Show.
Oh, wow.
A cup full of kooky.
Carl Stefanovic short-circuited.
So, yeah, there you go, you know. Tell them they're dreaming, how's the serenity, and that's fucked.
She's not wrong, is she? I mean, it is fucked. Correct answer.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
That was great. I watched that video after you sent through the audio, Daniel, because I had no idea of the clip. It is hilarious. And Michael Caton's just sitting there holding his phone, like he's having a Zoom chat or a FaceTime thing. And he's just sitting there being cruisy. He just doesn't give a care in a world.
And yeah, it's pretty obvious early on that like it sort of seems a bit like his wife is trying to prompt him almost.
Yeah.
Although I don't think, I don't know how, you know, like he is getting on. It is kind of nice to see also that he's able to work a mobile phone video connection. I suspect it's all that training from those very funny Kit Kat adverts.
I get it.
He's one of a couple of working from home wizards, basically.
Well, I'll have to look that up. I don't think I've seen them.
And yeah, absolutely flummoxing if you haven't.
Yeah, deep cut, man. Deep cut.
Thank you very much for that, Daniel. And now it's time for...
It's all in this week's TV Week, packed with great family entertainment.
Oh, Jesus!
Daniel Genie's Program Guide.
All right. So a couple of tidbits from the week. First of all, Ross Warnicki has a rumour in his Rewind column.
Oh, did you say Warnicki?
Warnicki! Oh, so long since we've heard that.
Dust that one off.
He says that rumour has it that Seven, smarting from the loss of Lois and Clark, the most watched show on Australian TV last week to Channel 9 from early next year, is close to poaching The X-Files and The Simpsons, among others, from Channel 10. Warnicki writes, it's a natural move. Those shows are produced for America's Fox Network, whose owner, Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, is also a big stakeholder in Seven.
Well, that hasn't happened for many a year.
Well, as far as I know, it didn't happen at all, at least with The X-Files and The Simpsons.
Well, X-Files ended up on Channel 7 like a few years later, played late at night. But Simpsons,
and
yeah.
Simpsons is, that was a few decades later. The other big thing in nerd news is Microsoft Windows 95 was released on Thursday the 24th of August. It had heaps of promotion, including a commercial which features this song. And I think that's all that we can pay to have, I think. So, the Rolling Stones song Start Me Up. The rumour was that Microsoft had paid the Rolling Stones between $8 and $14 million for use of the song in the ads. But Microsoft said that this was just a rumour spread by the band to increase their market value and that the figure was more likely $3 million.
Yeah, just simply ask The Verve. They will know about that.
Oh, yeah, Bittersweet Symphony.
Yeah.
Maybe they were talking about like Australian dollars, in which case it might well have been like that amount converted from US. They're not thinking that.
Quite possibly. Apparently there were people waiting in line at stores waiting to get a copy. Probably, similar to iPhone releases these days. I don't suppose any of you had Windows 95 Mania.
We did. When I was at university, I discovered the internet in 1995 when I was my first
Me
year
too.
Of uni. But we didn't have Windows 95 then, and that was like a monumental moment for me because I was a bit of a nerd, and then soon after started my own GeoCities page, which led to the Late Show dedication. Back in 1996, that was the first Late Show fan page on the internet. So that was my introduction to to the internet was at uni, and then Windows 95 was obviously August. So I think towards the end of that year, we got a new computer which had that on there. And Windows 95 is what popularized the internet, the web, because it was Internet Explorer was integrated into the system. But at uni, we were using
Mozilla. Much to the detriment of Netscape Navigator.
Netscape is what we were using at uni. So that was...
Netscape was the one that I remember using initially. And I stuck with Netscape for quite a long time until...
I know that because Internet Explorer was integrated into Windows 95, it was... a lot of people used it, but because I was used to Netscape, I used that, and it was definitely superior to Internet Explorer, which was really buggy and slow.
Yeah,
and,
I think even Edge these days isn't that brilliant compared to Chrome, but you know, let's not go off into that area.
It's true when they say that when you use Edge, it's mainly just to download Chrome or Firefox.
I liked the fact that Windows 95 exposed me to Weezer.
Oh yeah, that was the very small video clip.
There were two music videos on the CD-ROM: "Buddy Holly" by Weezer and "Good Times" by Edie Brickell.
Yeah,
that one probably not as well remembered as the Weezer one.
I did get a big thrill seeing Weezer live in concert in October 2023, and then when "Buddy Holly" came up, and went Windows 95 paid off.
They didn't play the start music or anything like that.
People do that at Rolling Stones gigs. Yeah. You hold off a Windows 95. Yeah.
Play the Windows song.
Yeah.
How does that go again?
This is all they play.
Yeah, that one.
That's it.
All right, we'll get on to the program guide proper now. So on the ABC, after Frontline, Four Corners and Media Watch, it's another episode of Absolutely Fabulous. Season 3, Episode 5, titled Fear, originally aired in the UK on the 4th of May 1995. Edina finds herself facing life without her daughter, Saffron, when she decides to leave home. Eddie's also having trouble holding on to her number one client, Scottish singer Lulu, who has this interaction with Eddie's dim-witted assistant, Bubble.
Funny you being called Lulu, though, because there were that one, weren't there? I'm just a jack in a box, you know, never know. Jump a panda, turn a string.
Oh, that was not me.
Here's one of yours, then.
No.
Go on. Don't be shy. I bet you've got a lovely voice when you try. Okay. Stop!
So, mistaking Lulu for Sandy Shaw there. Over on Channel 7, we've got Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman. Now that we've finished Season 2, they've gone back to a repeat from Season 1. Episode 15, titled Illusions of Grandeur, originally aired in the US in January 1994. Lois and Clark investigate a world-famous magician who they suspect is kidnapping wealthy children. And this episode just happens to guest star Penn Jillette, one half of the magic duo Penn and Teller, which is probably a good thing considering that Teller doesn't speak, so it's a good thing they didn't book him. It turns out that Penn's not playing the magician who's the suspect, just another magician who works with the suspect magician. Now, after that at 8:30 is a feature-length premiere. I want to see if you can work out what this show is just from the opening review here from Ross Warnicki. Take one Royal Canadian Mountie who is so sweet and kind that he puts that Dudley Do-Right to shame.
No, what's it called?
His lip reading deaf wolf called Diefenbaker and a smart-ass Chicago cop. Add some spectacular Yukon scenery, one dead Mountie and a herd of caribou who appear to have drowned on dry land, and you get a whodunit that is one of the most refreshingly over-the-top new shows of 95. So who do you reckon that what sort of show do you reckon that is?
I'm going to give it to Dom because Dom's our special guest. He put his hand up as well. So
It's got to be Dom.
What do you think it is?
It's got to be Due South.
Yeah, you win the fictional Tim Tams this episode.
Got to pick it up from Brashers.
I'm off.
Brashers sells Tim Tams.
Yay.
So it's the feature-length pilot. Which originally aired in Canada. Don't forget, this is a Canadian series. It originally aired in April 1994. And in the pilot, a constable and an undercover veteran form an unlikely partnership when a mysterious murder occurs. The crime has personal ramifications for both men.
Shocking horror.
So Due South stars Paul Gross as Constable Benton Fraser and David Marciano as Detective Raymond Vecchio. Yeah, it would then settle into its Thursday evening time slot.
And yes, they're all on, that entire season came out, or series came out on DVD too, but it's out of print now.
Although, mind you, it might have, like most of the stuff that comes out on DVD, might have had some of the music changed. Looking this up on Wikipedia, it says that there were two songs featured in the pilot, From a Million Miles by Australian EDM band Single Gun Theory and Superman's Song by Canadian rock band Crash Test Dummies.
Well, I know Single Gun Theory were signed to a Canadian label, weren't they? A Network Records, I think it was. A number of heaps of Australian sort of dance acts were all on Network.
Well, see, I'm starting to wonder whether Crash Test Dummies might have been put in there to try and satisfy those old Canadian content regulations.
You need to go.
The harmony, that was beautiful.
There's another sound grab right there.
Okay, over to SBS, and it's the season final of Defenders of the Wild. So in the previous weeks, we've seen activists trying to save honey buzzards, hawks, kestrels and other birds of prey in Italy, tigers in Thailand and Taiwan. There was a battle between poachers and rangers in western Nepal, and we got to see the sea shepherd do whatever they do in the sea. So to round things off, the British documentary examines primatologist Dr. Rufin Oko's protection plans for endangered species such as elephants, chimpanzees and gorillas in the Congo Odzala National Park.
Nice. Good stuff.
Well, I'm going to be sad that that goes.
Is that on DVD?
I'm hanging out for more hope and Gloria. That's what I'm hanging out for.
What's on next week on SBS? It's not going to be good subject matter. I'll put it that way. But also, if you're hoping for your Hope and Gloria fix this week, Alison, unfortunately, it's been preempted by a special event.
What's the special event? Is it a live Windows 95 launch? With the Rolling Stones?
Is it a charity challenge of some kind?
It's not even that cyber sitcom that they did to promote it, starring two of the people out of Friends.
No.
The Jennifer Aniston and Matthew Perry.
And that's the one, yeah. Not that, no. It's
So August 95, is it the end of World War II, like a 50th anniversary end of World War II kind of thing?
It's nothing to do with that, okay. But it's apparently a very... it's a much hyped news incident. It's probably more in the entertainment space than news. Something in the US. Something that happened in 1947.
Hugh Grant? Oh, no, something happened in 1947.
1947?
Oh, God, what happened in 1947?
It happened in Roswell, New Mexico.
Oh, okay.
Oh,
right.
So
this is a special called The Roswell Incident Aliens Revealed with the question mark there.
Oh,
yes.
I think I remember watching that when it was on TV.
Robin Oliver, writing in the Sydney Morning Herald Guide, laments that they had to drop Fraser at least for this. but he does say at least the network is sticking with comedy. He also writes, world first and about as believable as Superman. Couldn't be shown anywhere on Earth until this very day. Wreckage of a UFO and first footage, six toes to match six fingers, of an autopsy of one of the five aliens dragged from a spaceship that supposedly crashed near Roswell, New Mexico in 1947. Film shot by a military cameraman and acquired 46 years later by music video producer Ray Santilli. Suspicious? Nah.
You say military cameraman, like that's a thing, apparently.
Oh, I do remember watching that.
Bloody hell.
So do any of you remember any sort of big hype about this?
No.
Yeah, I do remember
none
this
whatsoever.
I remember watching it because there's a lot of grainy black and white footage of someone cutting up an alien on like a table. So
is it really obviously fake though? Because you know this military footage is somehow acquired by a music producer. Yeah, right. I mean, all my bullshit meters are going off at this point. What do you think Michael Caton's wife would think of this?
Oh yeah,
that's fucked.
Yeah.
Oh, that's my new favourite.
We're just going to be saying Michael Caton's wife, and you're going to have to press the button all throughout this.
And Mrs. Caton is not wrong, because it was revealed in 2017 that, yes, it was all faked.
Wait a minute.
It took them that long to reveal it was faked. I have a copy of... Women's Weekly from this month, which my daughter got from the Easter show because she got the Women's Weekly show bag. But there is literally an article in here called "It's about the original UFO hunters," and it talks about all these women in Australia. Like NASA has admitted, we may not be alone, but two Australian women who have been investigating strange lights in the sky for decades knew that, and they share their close encounters. So they talk about strange objects hovering over the trees and crashing into the gully, and there was some woman who said she saw a UFO flying towards her, but it was so quick that she couldn't capture any photographs, but there was all this green residue that ended up on her car. Luckily she had a paper towel and she wiped some of it up, and it's being analysed at the moment.
Right. So,
wow, I'd love to see the analysis about of that. These,
well, yeah, said there was and unknown origin or standard arrangement ratio, which is somewhat surprising and unexplained, a copper barium alloy.
Hmm. Suspicious? So, yeah. Or is it?
Let's do a bit Mike Moore impression.
So in 2017...
Something to think about there.
Yeah. So in 2017, Spiros Malaris admitted that the film was fake. The most prolific journalist on news.com.au, staff writers, wrote about the hoax. According to staff writers...
Do they never stop writing?
I love it.
Well, according to them, and I'm pretty sure staff writers is a they then.
Yes.
The bloated, pale-skinned, asexual alien was the creation of John Humphreys, otherwise known for his practical effects work with Doctor Who. He stitched cow's gizzards, a leg of lamb, and three sheep's brains into the foam latex carcass molded from his own 10-year-old son.
Oh.
Yeah.
So the lead roles of government pathologists were played by Malaris' friends and girlfriend, wearing outfits sourced from op shops or handmade. Mr. Malaris says he managed to fool Kodak as to the film's authenticity by shooting the scene on 16mm film before carefully splicing it with an old Pathé newsreel of a 1947 baseball match in Roswell. and it turns out that it was actually the second time they had to do this. After the first footage was completed, it was noticed some of the autopsy procedures were clearly incorrect, so they had to mould another alien and shoot it a second time.
Oh goodness gracious.
So they were worried about accuracy when it came to autopsies.
They were worried about not trying not to get found out, I think, is all about. they were thinking.
I even filled Kodak. That's all we need.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I'm sure there is a deep rabbit hole you could go down trying to find out more about how the hoax happened. All right, let's finish things off with Channel 10 at its Healthy, Wealthy and Wise. Ross looks at some alternative buying plans for your Christmas shopping. One wonders whether that might have been a bit of product placement for Crisco or not. Lynn travels to the Mornington Peninsula in Victoria and meets guitar master craftsman Richard Howell. And Ian prepares vegetable soup, or it could be the remnants from an alien autopsy. I'm not quite sure.
No, that would be full of brains and stuff.
Yeah, but he turned it into steak Diane sauce.
Yeah, you take a leg of lamb, you take some off
brains, yeah,
and you've got an amazing stew.
Yes.
We've been crapping on for far too long, so as they say in the classics, let's light some fires.
All right, thank you very much for all that program guide-ish thing stuff, Daniel. I appreciate it. All right, guess what it's time for? Dom, you are doing the intro, so get your mic more on. You ready for it? I'll count you in. You did community radio, so let's bring out your golden tonsils.
Hello, I'm...
No. Right, hope. 4, 3, 2, cue in.
Hello, I'm Domer. This is Frontline, Season 2, Episode 6, Let the Children Play. First broadcast Monday, August 28, 1995.
Well done! Yay. All those years at community radio paid off, Dom.
Yeah, I would say years, moment. I'd say weeks.
You all got to start somewhere. So, as Dom said, Season 2, Episode 6, Let the Children Play. The synopsis being Sam is keen to boost the ratings by building a playground for underprivileged kids, but he doesn't count on Mike offering to help out. Dot, dot, dot. That's exactly what's in the DVD cover, so leave me alone on that. But wow, this is going to be it's a very fast-paced and heavy one at the same time. I don't know, overall, that this somehow got through the keepers and managed to be broadcast on the ABC.
Amount of product placement.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's insane.
The whole joke is the product placement altogether, I guess.
Yeah, they kind of have to have it. But you see like massive big shots of it. And also in the credits, they're all thanked as well. So, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. We are in the kitchen with Mike introducing his niece Rebecca to Dom and Marty. So who is the daughter of Mike's sister? Just want to emphasize that. Well, that's what he did anyway. Uncle Mike. Who would have thought?
Yeah,
Uncle
and she's Mike. Doing some work experience and she's a media studies student.
Yep.
Yeah, who actually calls out all the crap.
Em, tell Sam we could have a walk-in.
Now, Sam's our EP. Do you know what EP stands for?
Enormous penis.
Where did you hear that, Rebecca?
Nice throwback to Season 2, Episode 1 there.
Yeah.
Definitely words got round about what that stands for.
Yes. But Rebecca also points out that the show follows a formula, and Mike says that Sam does his own thing and not watch over his shoulder. But then we do cut to Sam's office. The enormous penis office, and Sam tells, sorry, I'll call it properly, the executive producer office, and Sam tells Emma and Kate that he wants to do exactly what A Current Affair has done, and that is a charity challenge to help the underprivileged kids.
Channel 9 pinched the entire concept from England. Listen, we do one of these specials. Who do you think benefits?
Kids. The kids.
Exactly. And us. So it's a win-win situation.
Channel 9, A Current Affair, they were very well known to do pieces like this, weren't they, Dom?
Yeah, it was pretty common. I guess the merit of the episode, I guess, it all revolves around the fact that they're just elbowing in a lot of product placements and what have you. But I seem to remember another Ingrid Anderson challenge where they were trying to shoehorn in a bunch of celebrities instead of specific products. They weren't naming a lot of companies and sponsors, but they were... Angry Anderson was suddenly going to Julie Anthony's house. It was being flown there by helicopter to Julie Anthony's house to ask for support and that kind of thing. I thought each one of these challenges must have its own bizarre crowbar challenge associated with it as well.
How much petrol to use to get to those locations.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of driving around in a sort of open-top lot of Jeep thing, isn't there, and all that.
A Suzuki.
Yeah, a little Suzuki. Yes, I should have clocked what the sponsor of the car was. Yeah. Now, interestingly, in this episode of Frontline, there is a cut scene which occurs at this point, and it's in the book. And this is actually the last week we get to refer to the book, Frontline, the story behind the story, because this is the final episode that's in the book. They sadly didn't produce a second book of these scripts. So anyway, I'll read it's very short, this scene. So they have this scene where they're discussing doing the Angry Anderson style special, and then cut to a bistro. Sam is having lunch with a bald man wearing an earring. We do not see his face. Sam says, I mean angry. ACA are burying you. The odd special every 3 months. Come across the front line and you'll be weekly. What do you think? And then we cut to Mike and Rebecca in the office, which is the next scene. Mm. So I don't know if they ever shot it. It's certainly not in the episode, but yeah, interesting.
A little reminiscent of the one that they did with Clark and Dawes. It's kind of similar scene.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, yeah, it's exactly like that, isn't it?
And you sort of don't need that scene either, so I can see why they cut it, but that was the original plan.
And, yeah, it makes sense that, we don't see his face. I've got a feeling that if they did ask the actual Angry Anderson to do this as a cameo, I don't think he would have taken it very well, to be honest.
No.
And we all know who Angry Anderson is, the lead singer of Rose Tattoo, musician, occasional actor.
We know him from the Current Affairs Challenges.
And nothing else.
G'day, I'm Angry Anderson. Now, the idea of the challenge is to make the dreams come true for a special charity. Oh, sure, around the country there's many, many worthy causes, but we've decided to pick one. And with the awesome power of television and the goodwill of some wonderful people, we're going to help that charity with their special project. Now, we've heard that the Association for Spina Bifida here in Brisbane is in big trouble. In fact, they need some help, big time. So we're on our way to Cooperoo. That's where their headquarters is. We're going to find out exactly what the challenge is.
And he makes it, consuming so much petrol from the helicopter and the Jeep.
With the power of television.
Yes.
I like how they said that we've just heard that the Association for Spina Bifida is in trouble. They were said, we weren't briefed on this 10 minutes ago before we started rolling. We heard about this. A birdie told us, you know, and now we're going to do something about it.
Yeah, we received a press release, you know, or some kind of approach, you know, to the charity, because you can imagine that after they've done a couple of these, charities would be like lobbying a current affair to get on, wouldn't they?
Mm.
You know, it would get to that point with the PR reps for these charities or whatever.
Well, that one that clip is from is one that Dom had magically supplied, and it was one that he had to hold a concert at Brisbane Entertainment Centre and sell 10,000 tickets within 3 days.
Plus, there was also the challenge of assembling a world's largest orchestra as well to try and beat a Guinness World Record.
And they all got together and performed.
There.
Because they were in Queensland and that's where Charlene and Scott were living, so naturally.
See them all the time.
They have moved back to Melbourne, though. They've moved back to Ramsay Street, if you watch the final episode of Neighbours before they revived it 6 months later. Yep. Sorry,
and then they realised that.
No, there was a fair bit of gratuitous use of Bound for Glory in that special as well.
Yeah.
Bogan classic after Bogan classic.
In Mike's office, he and Rebecca are going through the ratings rundown, which is absolutely freaking hilarious, when Dom barges in telling him that he's been offered a free weekend accommodation at Threadbo, because that's where all the celebrities are going to go, which he approves discreetly.
If I could just backtrack a bit when Rebecca's actually talking about the TV ratings and she's asking, you know, is it actually a percentage of who's watching or is it, you know, the pure numbers? But if you want the answer, is anyone interested in the answer of what that actually means?
Go on, let's hear it.
So I've got the in my old uni textbook about the media in Australia, television ratings. So the word rating actually refers to the percentage of homes with a television set that actually watched a particular program. For example, if your favourite program has scored a rating of 15, this means that 15% of the number of homes with the TV sets watch that program. But this is not a percentage of the homes who actually have their TV sets on. If, for example, only 60% of all TV sets were turned on at the time the rating was taken, then the rating of 15 would represent a share of 25% of the audience. Rarely will there be more than 80% of homes included in any one reading. Wow. Does that make any sense?
It feels so needlessly specific. Complicated.
As confused as Mike.
Yeah.
I think Mike was right to be a little bit confused by that by the definition.
But okay, when
I guess the higher the number, the
but
better.
In Frontline, when they read out the ratings and they say, "Oh, we got 25 or 30 or something," are they which one are they talking about of those two figures? We don't know, do we?
See, no, they don't specify. Yeah. I thought it was the ones that the homes who've had them TV sets, the number of times of TV sets who watched it, but then maybe it's who's got it on. Don't know, but I know it's all comparative, so.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think that who's the percentage of people who've got it on who are watching your program would be the more accurate figure.
That would make more sense.
Anyway, write in if you know.
Yeah, if you know the answer. All I know is that the Current Affair, you know, in real life was always in the top 10 when they list the top 10, up with, you know, Australia's Funniest Home Videos, which they make reference to as well. So
do you know your ratings result, Dom, from your Mastermind episode? Did you beat Bluey?
Well, not that day, no way. I don't think anything beats Bluey.
Well, actually,
if they had a choice between Bluey and me,
I'm sorry to be the person who well actually is this, but well actually, Bluey doesn't get counted in the ratings anymore because it's under 10 minutes.
Oh,
because the new ratings
does it need to have that qualification?
It does. They changed the measurement or the methodology earlier this year to try and bring in people who watch via an area or people who watch live on the streaming apps or people who watch on demand later.
The way that they do the percentage though, or the sample rate, it's if you have you got on for 15 seconds, it's count as a viewer point. So therefore, suddenly you've got your show has gone from like 700,000 viewers to 2.3 million, and that's the total amount. So it's confusing as all hell.
It's even more confusing now because it's basically it's a national viewing figure as well. So we don't get to see what the ratings are like in different cities, for instance.
If you want a good breakdown, a really simple breakdown of it, look at tvtonight.com.au. David Knox actually does a good rundown of it. Back to the ratings rundown, though, with Mike and Rebecca.
So what's this here, HUTS?
HUTS. Well, that's an acronym.
What's it stand for?
Oh, it's a Latin-y thing. I think it's Humanus Unctus.
Homes using television?
You know.
Uh-huh.
Then what'd you ask me for?
Because Marty told me to ask you.
Oh, that's just wasting my time.
Marty has a story to chase while a lady has refused to talk to the media as her husband has just been shot, which is Marty's story. So Rebecca tags along with Stu and Jace as well, off camera. Sam chats to Mike about the ratings result after the Current Affair Charity Challenge flogs him. And after The Art of Gentle Persuasion, I'm noticing that a lot now ever since.
Yeah, well,
it seems to happen regularly.
From Sam towards Mike, trying to make it seem like it was his idea.
Hey, Mike, to hell with it. Let's do it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Do what?
A charity special.
Great.
Probably whack a host in the centre.
Yep.
Right, probably an ex-muso.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, a challenge.
Yep.
And a deadline. Right.
Oh.
What?
Aren't we getting a bit close to what Nine are doing?
Oh, bugger them, Mike. We thought this up totally independently, right here, right now. I mean, you were here, weren't you?
Yeah,
right.
We just fleshed it out just then.
Okay, right, so let's do it,
Let's do it. Let's get the ball rolling.
Let's get the ball rolling.
Sam, got some really good charity causes.
For what?
For you to donate to that whole tax thing.
Nice cover up.
I'll just slightly backtrack from that clip that you played.
Sure.
Just before that, at the start of the scene where Sam is starting to try and convince Mike to do this charity special, there's actually a cut. Well, it's a cut stage direction in the book that I noticed. And Mike saying, you know, you're your own man, you know, you shouldn't be sort of party to a cynical knee-jerk response like copying what a Current Affair's doing. And the bit that's cut is that Sam turns away from Mike and mouths the word F, so the F word, okay? and then he kind of turns back to Mike and you know, the scene continues. So they actually cut the mouthing of the F word from that. Maybe they sort of used up all their quota in the previous episode where they had Hugh the editor mouthing the F word.
A character does do it later on in the episode.
Yeah.
So maybe they only had one.
They can only do one mouthing of the F word. Per episode.
Yeah. I think the other thing I like is that Sam is manipulating Mike sort of like the special is going to manipulate the viewers pretty much. It's almost the same level of contrivance. We thought of it right here, right now.
I heard the whole thing.
There we go. It's on record. I did forget to mention, though, that Sam does point out that as he's trying to describe, you know, trying to justify his moment about the...
Oh, utilitarianism.
The John Stuart Mill quote.
Yeah, the John Stuart Mill utilitarianism, greatest people help for the... or something. I can't remember what it is now. I'm going to have to look at the book.
Yeah. I'm looking at the book at the moment.
Page 219.
That's the one. Yeah.
Yes. There we go. All three of us combined to get that part out. So remember that for later on. Now we're out into the office main area and they're having a blue sky session. And that is Emma, Kate and Sam are on the whiteboard hashing out ideas.
Yeah, if you want a really un-PC list, that's a list there.
Sure is. Oh, let me just list the hosts instead.
You can freeze frame it at your own leisure with your copy.
So they were thinking of Farnsey, Neil and Tim Finn, Glenn Shorrock. Here's one thing I do need to point out with Glenn Shorrock. is everyone else thinking what I'm thinking?
Pedantry.
They wrote Glenn Shorrock incorrectly.
Well, to be fair, they misspelled all the charities incorrectly, not to mention offensively. Yeah. So,
that's by the by. But I'm talking about Glenn's first name. It's double N, not one N, as they wrote. So, just want to point that out. And also, they had the Dattos listed as well. Stevie Wright, that was a name from the past, and good old Sherl.
Which, according to the script book, is crossed out. So I think that might have been either at the request of Brooke or, you know, might have had something to do with his previous appearance on Frontline, perhaps.
Well, you could easily have plugged the Happy Healthy Hippie Hut. Or the Happy Hippie Hut.
Yeah. No, I think it might have also been crossed out because Sherl might have been too busy with this show. Wouldn't it be lovely?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Well, could it? And I can say this because Sherl's dead and can't sue. Could it have been because he was because, you know, they say we need a muso drug free. Was he a user of the illicit, you know, chemicals? Don't know.
No idea. But I swear. I'm saying this too because he's dead as well, so you can't sue me. But I'm pretty sure Stevie Wright was clean as.
Okay.
I think I remember also Sherl was on the Brisbane Footy Show in 1995 as well. He was like a co-host when there was three different footy shows. Yeah. There was Billy J. Smith hosted it in, I think it was 95 or 94, and there was like Michael O'Connor was a co-host and Gary Belcher and Tony Durkin, and on the end, Shirley Strawn, inexplicably.
But Shirl's from Melbourne, but he was a rugby. He knew about rugby. Yeah. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Well, then again, he also in later in life, he hosted the Triple M Breakfast Show in Brisbane.
Oh.
Yeah, he became a bit of a Brisbane favourite in the mid-90s.
That would have been interesting to see a Datto try and help out with a charity.
Yeah, do you have a preferred Datto?
Probably not the one who sang 4.5 minutes of shit.
Yeah, because you'd have to put up with 24.5 minutes of it for the whole episode.
Mm. The Zeppo Datto would have helped.
Surely his hair would have.
I was going to say Bashful Datto.
No such thing.
Wait, what was... Like 95, was World's Greatest Commercials going to air at that time?
I think it was. I think it might have been on Sunday night.
Yeah, so it could have been Andrew Dutto and Kane.
Yeah, pity that the dog wasn't on the whiteboard there.
We're looking for a host for this TV charity special. Muso, some TV experience?
Drug-free. That narrows the field. John English.
Hey, not bad.
Where'd you pull that name out from, Brooke?
Excuse me, Emma, we met on a 40-hour famine launch.
About as long as the relationship lasts.
Can I ask for suggestions?
Suss it out, will you?
Sure. You got the number, Brooke?
Yes.
40-hour famine from 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. And
So there's a lot of references from previous episodes.
Yes.
John English is a really good fit, I think, because, he was the star of his own sitcom, as we all remember. I thought you'd have the theme song.
And I've got the box set over there.
Oh, well, what you don't have.
Yeah.
what you don't have, and I'm very pleased you're not going to play, hopefully, is the music that was in the closing titles, which was Bobby Rivers' hit Easy Street, which I remember as being like the crappiest song I've ever heard. It was something like going down the corner of Easy Street or something ridiculous. It was terrible. And I think how is this guy like living off the earnings of this crappy song?
Oh.
And look, if you don't have the DVDs like we do,
I do not own them.
I was just going to say that you can watch All Together Now on a streaming service that's run by Umbrella Entertainment called Broly.
What?
And it's free. It's free to join Broly, isn't it?
Is it?
It's ad supported, yeah.
Yep.
Broly.
Oh, I'm watching it for Bruno Lucia only.
Yeah.
Cheeky babe. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's our outro for this podcast. Stay beautiful.
What? What? Beautiful. Not Michael Caton's wife.
So looks like John English is definitely on board.
You're doing it for the kids.
Great. How long we got?
Well, as long as you like. Weeks. We've got to make it look like it's been done within 24 hours, though.
Why?
Well, you know how it is, John. Bit of showbiz, race against time.
Right.
Right. Now, what you do, this is how it happens, right? You roll up, you ask the kids what they really want, and they'll say, a playground.
They actually want a basketball court.
Too late, we're going with a playground. So you've got 24 hours to meet the challenge.
According to legal, we can't use the word challenge.
And yet, throughout the episode, they refer to it as a challenge. But, hey, John's on board, so... Yes, bond as a team. Rebecca is back in the office after tagging along with Marty and revealing to Uncle Mike of the tricks Marty did to obtain the photo of the lady's dead husband. So we all know that stuff, but Mike doesn't. And he's like, yeah, whatever. But Mike gives a tour of the studio where she's actually a bit disappointed about the auto cue.
Cameras, of course, and that's an auto cue machine.
Everything's written out for you.
Well, not for me. I mean, for the people in the studio, they need it.
Even your reactions are written.
Well, no, I mean, that says smile there, but, I mean, that's open to interpretation. I improvise a lot. I mean, you broad the whole smile spectrum.
Well, what's the story about?
Here's a rundown. Used cars. It's one of Brooks.
But what's it about?
Well, cars.
Just not a very impressed niece.
No,
yeah, she's certainly quite a canny person, isn't she? You know, she's really picked up a bunch of stuff on media sites. I'm wondering if you were like this, Kim, if you would have reacted similarly.
Yeah, I think so. I think she's part of the generation where she's quite media savvy, and I think obviously Frontline itself was helping to kind of educate people and inform them of the tricks of the trade and the way this kind of stuff was being used. And I think at this point with, you know, Windows 95 on the horizon and the internet, it's, you know, all the kind of mainstream old school media was becoming just a little bit, you know, cliched and predictable. So I think Rebecca's there to kind of illustrate that, you know, the old school, old guard and that media outlets are becoming, and, you know, the new future, which was, you know, me, and now I'm I'm middle-aged myself and wearing reading glasses, so
aren't we all?
Now, also, I don't feel like we should be too harsh on somebody putting the word smile on an auto cue, because I'm pretty sure that further along in Frontline, there's an example of Mike reading a very serious down story, in an up voice and vice versa. So, just putting smile on there, or just like knowing that, you know, you introduce this next song, this next story, in a happy tone, that's not a bad thing, really.
Yeah, I think if you're, particularly if you're going from a very serious story to something lighter or vice versa, you've absolutely got to tell the host that they need to change their reaction.
Especially a host which will read anything on the prompter.
Yes.
Yeah, and he has absolutely no idea what the story actually is about.
Now they're in the edit suite where they watch Brooke and Hugh put together a story.
Well, now that the story's edited, it can go in the show.
So when a story's boring, we add music, and when it's really boring, we put it in fast motion.
I love you. I just love you. He's yeah, so good.
Like, oh my God, you've cracked the code.
But both Brooke and Mike were just speechless. Especially Brooke was just like, oh.
I mean, if anything, the only thing that Brooke's story could really be accused of is using quite a hacky choice of music to finish her story about trying to buy a used car. Just going the hacky Fine Young Cannibals route.
And there's plenty more cliched music to come. Don't worry about that.
Well, other than Drive You Crazy, they could have, or Drive Me Crazy, they could have used maybe The Cars. Yeah. Who's going to drive you home?
They could have used Fast Car.
Fast Car.
They probably couldn't afford the Beatles.
Yeah. Oh, that's true. Maybe, beep, beep. Yeah. So now it's time for the production meeting.
Marty, the murdered guy's wife. Still not talking, but we did manage to find this little exclusive.
How'd you get that?
Oh, he tricked the wife into giving it to
him. Excuse me. And we could have an interview with the cops as well.
Okay, what else?
Brooke's got a gay teacher.
They've been contacted by a guy who claims he's been dismissed by the education department for being homosexual.
Is he a poof?
Hey, Marty.
Is the story ready to go?
Oh, we're just waiting for permission from the ABC to use some overlay.
Oh, overlay is extra footage we use to help illustrate a story.
Okay, so in this one you'll be using stuff from the gay Mardi Gras.
How'd you know that?
Well, every time you do a story on homosexuals, you always use stuff from the gay Mardi Gras.
Wow. She's a real... I love her just for calling this stuff out, but she's also quite an interesting kind of theatrical device, as it were, because, like, they quite often in Frontline episodes, they need to have a character who kind of, you know, explains how stuff's working, right? So sometimes they have it where they'll have sort of dialogue between, I don't know, Sam and one of the production assistants or something, and that way they'll kind of explain how current affairs works. But with this one, it's quite interesting. You've got this outsider coming in and just calling them out for all their cliches. So it's certainly...
She's the Frank Grimes of Frontline.
Yeah, she absolutely is. Yeah, because Mardi Gras was quite recent to television, wasn't it? I think the first time they broadcast it was... You're going to know, aren't you, Daniel? You're going to tell us.
Tell you all about the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras.
Go for
That's
it.
That's a bit gay.
Oh, bloody hell.
Sorry, I just had to. I'm sorry.
Apologies to get this.
Yeah, we'd like to apologise to the LGBT plus community at this point.
Yeah. So you are right. The televising of the Sydney Mardi Gras parade is a very new thing. It only started the previous year in 1994, and there was quite a lot of opposition to it. But thankfully, it did go ahead. You can watch. The ABC has put the whole 1994 parade up on YouTube. But as far as I can tell, just having a scant look at the footage that was used later on in the episode, it looks like this came from the 1995 parade. I've got a bit of a look at the intro and a look at who hosted and commentated.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this, the ABC
street under glorious Sydney skies, where hundreds and thousands of people have come out to show their support for Sydney's gay, lesbian and greater queer community as they celebrate in a show of pride, unity and fabulous frocks that the fuller bottomed of us could only dream of fitting into. Perched high above me in the safety, comfort and dryness of his Oxford Street lounge room is our specialist comments man tonight, Julian Cleary, and via a sophisticated telecommunication system, we will be maintaining contact with Julian. Is Julian ready? Yep. Julian! Can you hear me, Julian? Julian!
Yes, I can hear her. I think that's quite enough contact with Elle for one evening. Well, I am Julian Cleary, specially imported to Australia for this evening's events, but I'm not alone in my lounge. There are a couple of people over here. Hello, Angela Caterns.
Hello, Julian. Good evening, everybody.
And playing footsie with her is David Marr.
Good evening, Julian, and hello to everybody.
Right. So there we go. Also, not featured in that intro was also Julie McCrossan, who was roving around interviewing participants and spectators. So, yeah, an interesting foursome there. Yeah, especially Angela Caterns was doing her morning show on Triple J. And David Marr at the time had a show on Radio National on weekdays called Arts Today. And, of course, would go on to be one of the hosts of Media Watch later on.
Oh, well, there you go.
Mm. I remember that people, well, there were some negative reactions about Julian Cleary hosting. They thought that he was being a bit sort of sarcastic and dismissive of what was going on. And to be fair, that's kind of his comedy style. He was always...
That's his shtick, yeah.
Yeah, that's absolutely his shtick. But some people sort of, I don't know, either didn't quite get it or felt offended by it or didn't appreciate what he was doing anyway. So, yeah, I think he divided opinion. But, I mean, I love Julian Cleary. I used to watch Sticky Moments, as I'm sure many of us used to do on a Friday evening.
Yeah, definitely watch that.
And the reason why I know that it came from the 1995 parade is that there's rain coming down in the few shots that are used on Frontline, as well as a very wet ground. It doesn't look like it's the same shots from the parade video from 95 that I could find on YouTube with its very poor visual and audio quality. Sorry about that, listeners. But, yeah, basically it rained in 1995 and it didn't in 1994, so I'm very certain that it came from the 95 parade.
Who was it? Who was the guy who would pray for rain? That
Fred Nile,
Christian.
Oh, Fred Nile.
Yes. Oh, so he got his wish in 95 because he and any all his Christian mates would be there, wouldn't they, praying for rain as the parade went
on?
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
It's raining men.
Yes, it rained men instead of water.
Yeah. To be fair, a little sprinkle is not going to stop people from celebrating, you know, especially in defiance of, shitty people Fred. Like Fred Nile.
Fred and co, yes.
Yeah. So Emma also mentions the charity challenge where they've organised John English to build a playground for underprivileged inner city kids, in which Rebecca points out that it's exactly like the Angry Anderson specials.
True.
So, calling it as it is, yep. After explaining some of the businesses that want some extra advertising privileges, the team does get it underway. And now we're in Jeff's office, though, with Rebecca calling out Mike a few times in his stories. Rough day, it's 11 a.m. Jeff explains that his celebrity auctioneer, Johnny Phelps from Jackpot, has pulled out of the Spastic Centre charity function and needs Mike's help. So Mike accepts and gives Jeff an update on what they're actually doing with John English.
Do you hear what we're doing with John English?
No.
Well, we're my idea. Mm. We're getting him to build a playground for underprivileged kids.
Great, just like those Angry Anderson
No, no. I knew you were going to say that. Yeah, no, this is the problem with harnessing a concept.
Mm-hmm.
First, it's very different from Angry Anderson.
Right.
There was two. Greatest good for the greatest number. Utilitarianism, Sir John Mills.
The actor.
Mm.
Sir John Mills. Just to point out that Sir John Mills, the actor, was born from 1908 and passed away in 2005, who starred in The 39 Steps, Gandhi, Swiss Family Robinson, and Bean, the ultimate disaster movie. and
arguably his best.
Yes, but I think, you know, Mike was referring to John Stuart Mill, who was born from 1806 to 1873.
Yeah, different people.
But
yeah,
yeah. Though I did like John Stuart Mill's performance in Bean.
Yeah,
he was pretty damn
good.
Yeah,
he nailed it.
He played Whistler's mother. Now to Emma, who is out and about with John English filming away for the special.
Well, as you can see, it's a pretty run-down neighbourhood. Not much for kids to do. But we're going to try and fix all that. So we're going to need a lot of help from a lot of people. But you know, the funny thing about us Aussies, we always dig deep without asking for anything in return.
Cut.
What's wrong?
I couldn't see the Suzuki logo.
Sorry, John.
Oh, sorry.
It does echo.
G'day. I'm Angry Anderson. Now, the idea of the challenge is to make the dreams come true.
You know, that guy that I played earlier.
It's note for note, isn't it? And Dom, you very kindly shared a couple, well, you sort of found a couple of episodes of Angry Anderson's specials, and it was just astonishing to watch what the frontline team had parodied and how note for note they'd copied, you know, these actual specials.
Well, the thing about it is, I remember the Siege episode of Frontline, where Mike is talking to the girl in the house, that seemed like verbatim from Mike Willis's call.
Yeah,
it was
on A Current Affair. So it feels like that this episode is just, it's not even a parody. It almost sounds verbatim.
Yeah,
line for line, almost. Mm. The cadence is certainly exactly the same.
Well, are you saying that they're following a formula?
Look, call me radical if you want, but there it is.
All right. Everyone's Rebecca on this podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, forget Karen. We're animal. All Rebeccas.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Sam's freaking out that Emma's not around the office to find a builder for the playground, and Mike decides to take it upon himself to organise one, using the utilities of Emma's very messy desk, in which he finally finds some details. And guess who was also in the scene?
Ooh.
Oh, it's old mate.
Yay, Konica.
Colin Konica is in there for just a split second or so when Mike moves a bit and then he just appears there and he's, yeah.
That is
really
a good spot because
really
I did not spot that. So, good spot.
When it came to Tommy G's subliminal appearances in Frontline, I had a theory that in the Hollow Men, Tommy G was dressed up as Santa Claus in the last scene when Rob Sitch says, "Hello, Mr. Prime Minister." I think that may have been Tommy G and Santa in the Santa Claus outfit.
Wow. Well, we'll have to look out for that.
Because the Prime Minister isn't mentioned directly in The Hollow Men, but I think it was intended to be like one shot of maybe his back of his head or something. But because it was set at Christmas, I think Tommy G may have been dressed as Santa
Claus. Well, guess who has just invited himself to be on that episode to review when we do Follow Men?
Yeah, we'll see you in 10 years.
Sounds good.
There's a lot to get through.
I'll have a better microphone by then.
But maybe we should do a charity challenge to get you a better microphone.
You've got 24 hours.
Yeah, done. And
I want Andrew Datto as well.
We will scour the land of Officeworks and JB Hi-Fis to get you a new microphone.
That's great. Oh, man, it'll make my day. Truly, will it?
But back to location filming and Emma preps John for his next steps.
Well, before we build our playground, we're going to have to find a place to build it. And who better to find us a piece of local real estate than the local mayor? Now, we are taking a bit of a punt dropping in unannounced like this, so let's just hope he's in, eh? G'day.
Hi, John.
Is the Lord Mayor in?
Yeah, he's expecting you.
Hang on, Cart.
Cheryl, remember this whole thing's a surprise to you.
Yeah.
Okay, let's try it again.
Okay.
And also the mayor pops out dressed up to the nines.
The bit where the mayor comes out in the full, like, chains and everything.
And the robe, yeah.
And it's like, you don't need to have all that on.
And it's just at the end of this scene where we get to, I don't think we even see, but we hear a muted bit of audio where I'm very sure that Emma dropped an F-bomb.
Yeah.
She did. She absolutely did.
That's the one.
Yeah.
There you go. Splice that back into the episode. And I think, yeah, like it does really highlight And again, seeing the source material, the original ACA episodes, you do see a hell of a lot of contrivance going on and sort of stuff that has been, like, it's all been worked out beforehand, you can tell, but they've got to have the bit on camera where they, you know, go into a bank to try and, you know, organise a bank account to, you know, to put all the money in, for instance.
Oh, there's some... The St. George one? Is that what you're referring to? Yeah. I got up to that far in that episode of the Angry Anderson one where they're carrying buckets of cash through Meyer Center. So, he's like, oh, the big paint bucket type things. And he's like, oh, I don't know what I'm going to do with all, you know, it's carrying around all this cash. And there's, as they're on the escalator, there's a guy standing behind Angry Anderson and on camera. The stranger throws some money into the bucket. It's like, oh, thanks, mate. It's like,
just on
it wasn't
cue.
For the camera. I'm pretty sure he would have taken some coin.
Yeah. Like the other, just while we're talking about contrived moments, the other one which really stood out for me in the Angry Anderson special was right at the start where he goes to the Spina Bifida Association and there's a shot of a kid in like a play set sort of thing. Like it's basically sort of like from, it's a shot from inside the area that Angry Anderson is entering. So, like if you think about it, like the cameraman would have had to introduce themselves, especially considering there's young children about. Like it's sort of like when a TV personality enters a building and the shot of the person inside the building going to open the door and greet the television personality is all shot from the inside of the building, you know, like, you know that they've had to rock up and say, hi, we're here to film this and, you know, can you just act surprised and all that?
Don't you have a generic person standing in your hallway waiting for someone to knock
on
the
camera.
Door? With a camera?
With a beta camera.
Don't you have one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The bit that I imagined with the Spina Bifida episode is it's all these kids with Spina Bifida and there's no way any of them would know who Angry Anderson is, but yet the kids have to be excited about seeing him. So, like, they would have to explain, this is a guy you get excited by, you know?
I always think that was the reason for slow motion, you know?
Yeah.
Just because we don't have a long shot of the kid being really happy. Keep that beaming smile on their face for, like, another second. All right, we'll slow it down to 50%. And it'd be fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's an excellent Mitchell and Webb sketch that Rebecca, like, pierces all of these holes in the television magic that happens.
Mm. Yep. In the studio, Mike reiterates to Rebecca that how much he has to crystallise the back announcing of stories, even if he hasn't seen the story. And cue the homosexual teacher story tease with footage of the gay and lesbian Mardi Gras that Rebecca predicted.
Yeah.
The next day, in Sam's office, Jan runs over Mike's press release and schedule to promote the charity challenge.
Now, we've lined up quite a few radio interviews for you to do, so here is the list.
Sure, it's a pretty heavy schedule.
Oh, my dear, we have got to let everybody know what a wonderful job you're doing. There's no point in hiding yourself under a bushel.
Well, it's just good to be able to give of yourself. Breakfast radio.
Too early?
7:45. Makes for a long day.
Oh, don't worry, darling. We'll do a pre-record.
Speaking of which, we're going to pre-record your links for the special.
When?
Thursday after the show.
Great. Because I'm going skiing on the weekend. That means I can leave Thursday night.
Yeah. So self-centred, right?
Mm. The thing about the charity challenge is that Mike only gets, you know, what would be 2 or 3 minutes of airtime. So I was always wondering if Ray Martin, for instance, just had, you know, wanted to go see a Souths game that Friday night and goes, can we just pre-record so I can go see this game, please?
I'm going to have to relook at those specials that you sent through.
Exactly. There's got something more to it.
Yeah. Is he wearing the same tie as he was on the Thursday episode of ACA? You know, or the same jacket or shirt? Or did they change them all to try and fool
yeah,
you.
Well, do they film him from the top up because down the bottom he's got his board shorts on and about to go hit the beach?
The same attention to detail.
It's just a wall behind him, and behind him is the Bahamas or something.
Yeah, it's the same attention to detail as the Roswell documentary makers when they did the autopsy wrong. They just had to make sure that the tie was, you know, some consistency had to be
done. Just in terms of attention to detail, just watching the charity, the Angry Anderson charity special from 94, you know, Ray Martin's hair is absolutely this from Frontline, you know. It's exactly
it's the kind Mike of Lego Moore. Hair that you,
I'm looking that at really it. I'm looking at the cover of the Frontline book, and I'm looking at Ray Martin, and it's just, I'm just sitting there going, they're exactly the same hair. You know, I knew they were, but just reminding myself of how close, you know, how much of a piss take of Ray Martin it is, you know?
Yeah, it's the 1994 era of Ray Martin.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
Yep. Well, that makes Eric Banner's hair in Full Frontal all the more real as well.
Yeah.
It was dead set, a plastic helmet. But
his was like really shiny and very obviously plastic in kind of bouffant. It was like it was moulded out of like, you know, some kind of hard material.
They lifted it off a big Lego man and put it on.
Yeah, it was the Lego man haircut.
Now, back on location with John English, and they're at Mitre 10, where the staff member rattles everything off the Father's Day catalogue and on the shelves.
Wow.
So he was promised.
Yeah.
Well, I remember the parallel to the, I think True Value Hardware was the one that they were plugging on A Current Affair in every other shot. I think they had like 4 or 5 stickers on the Jeep. And also everyone was wearing a True Value cap, I think, as well.
Yeah, and he had it on his shirt as well, didn't he? He had the hardware, like, badge on. Yeah.
I really have a gut feeling that they used the episode of the Spina Bifida one to be inspired for this episode, because just the parallels are just too common.
Well, see, the thing is that the source material we had access to was 2 episodes, one from 1994... and one from 1998, which obviously postdates the Frontline episode we're looking at now. But even despite that, there's still a heck of a lot of notes, which are the same, you know, between editions.
Yeah. It was a formula.
Yeah, the template.
It was formula.
Yes.
Yeah.
Formula.
Yeah.
Now, in the voiceover suite, Rebecca and Hugh are bonding over a smoke while Brooke lays the voiceover story that the BBC produced word for word.
Here in the Muslim enclave of Bihach, shelling has continued non-stop since the last UN-brokered ceasefire collapsed on the weekend. For the residents, time is running out.
So she just reads what he said, but in her own voice.
Uh-huh. Makes it look like we've done the story.
Does she add anything?
Oh, yeah.
What?
Brooke Vandenberg reporting.
You can just hear when Jane Kennedy used to be on Eon FM, when she was the newsreader before officially joining the DJ, where that newsreader style comes from. So channeling that, I guess. Back to Emma and John with the Ericsson phone ringing midway through John's phone conversation and standing in front of the Suzuki Jeep. I'm pretty sure I've got some brand names in there. On the vacant lot, though, Emma preps the underprivileged kids with McDonald's.
Yeah.
Mac time. Yep. While John films a piece to camera, thanks to Fox Hay Timber and Hardware.
Right now, this is just an abandoned lot, but thanks to the generosity of the people we've spoken to today, we plan to turn it into a playground. A playground for needy kids like Josh. What do you reckon, Josh?
It's great.
Yeah, where did you play before?
We don't have nowhere.
If we... Who took my wallet?
It was simulated acting there.
Yes, that's a performance worthy of Pisswick kidism, yeah.
Yeah.
I always wondered about that style of directing. Is you just put a kid on that wants to be on camera and just not direct them at all? Or do you have to over-direct them to say that you have to say this in a Pisswick way? Or you just say nothing at all. Just, here's the line, just say it, it's fine.
Wasn't the deal with the Pisswick kids that they basically didn't know the dialogue and they're just given it and told to perform it, so they've had no rehearsal, and so that's how they got the Pisswick
performances? It couldn't be directed, could it? It just doesn't sound like it could be.
No.
We'll have to go back to our episode when we actually had one of the Pisswick kids
Justin
on.
And Nick Anderson, episode episode 40 of the Champagne Comedy Podcast. So
wow.
Go back there and you'll find...
You're able to remember that easily?
Oh, yeah. It was an iconic episode of ours. In makeup now, and Rebecca is seeing more through Mike's bullshit with Kate supplying his questions. He also asks stylist Steve to borrow his lip gloss for the skiing weekend. Ugh. I don't understand people sharing lip gloss.
Yeah.
And Jeff charges in with the signage for the charity event that's happening on Saturday, the same weekend of the ski weekend. So, great.
Just on that charity event, is that the host of Jackpot is always mentioned on Frontline? Would that have been, I know it's not a, they're not seen or really spoken about in any detail, but would that have been modelled on anybody they were thinking of in particular? I mean,
I think every other
element of the show is modelled on... It is Glenn. Okay, right.
Well, because, you know, there's the episode... For some reason,
I had Baby John in my head.
Well, there's the episode where they shoot the network promo and you see Jackpot briefly and the guy from Jackpot looks kind of like Glenn Ridge, and then he's got a sort of lady assistant and she looks a lot like Nikki Buckley, who I think was the hostess of... what was the program? Sale of the Century at the time. Yeah. So I think the reference is Sale of the Century more than Wheel of Fortune.
So it wasn't My Generation or Time Masters or...
No, Tony Johnston there or Michael Pope. Now it's time for Mike's charity special pre-records.
Hi, thanks for joining us. Tonight, a very special edition of Frontline. Yesterday we came up with a crazy concept. We heard about a bunch of inner city kids who had nowhere to play. So I rang up an old mate of mine, John English. And I said, John, you got 24 hours to build a playground. Does he succeed? Let's find out.
Cue the Bryan Adams.
Cue the vignette of John English building the playground for kids to the Bryan Adams classic, parentheses, everything I do, close parentheses, I do it for you.
Although the book suggests that they also could have used Where Do the Children Play by Cat Stevens, and I'm assuming that Bryan Adams's agent offered a more competitive rate for the song purchase than Cat Stevens. Who knows? Or Yusuf Islam, as he is now, of course.
And you know what the scary part is? I unintentionally did a minor deep dive because of Bryan Adams' usage. That song... was so goddamn popular. It pretty much reached number one in every single country except for about four or five. But that's all we need to know. If you want to hear it on repeat, watch MTV 90s. It's on at least once an hour.
Yeah, it's amazing to just see all of the blatant product placement that occurs throughout the montage, and then shortly thereafter there's a nice fat juicy Frontline would like to thank with a bunch of logos scrolling. So
did you read the names in the credits?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like there's, you know, places like Albert Park Deli.
No, but I'm talking about the people that they did special thanks to.
Oh, yes, I did see that as well.
Did you make note of some of the recognised
names? There's a certain special effects person.
Yeah.
Aaron Beaucaire.
Yep, Dr. Aaron Beaucaire. Stephen Amos, who is the cinematographer for Funky Squad and Frontline.
Mm.
Also, Tim Ferguson gets a mention.
Mm.
As well as Hedley Gritter and Chris Hatzis, both of, The Party Show. Yeah, look, it's just amazing to see the amount of sponsors that they're able to cram into the montage. I mean, we've got Albert Park Deli, Delta Demolitions.
Who says you can't advertise on the ABC?
But there's also a few more.
There's a few more, Daniel.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, there's City Suzuki and Transplex Constructions.
Who says you can't advertise on the ABC?
There's Minor 10, Finsbury Way Productions, McDonald's, bloody McDonald's.
We apologise for this interruption. Unfortunately, a technical problem prevents us continuing our scheduled programme for the moment. In the meantime, we bring you a brief alternative program.
You broke it.
Oh, my God. The episode has broken the catchphrase. Too much product placement.
Can I just ask some questions about that little sort of sting that you have created there, Matt? Because I like how it sounds a bit like it's a cash register sort of noise, but also is that like a 1980s ABC iDent sort of music?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the one where it's like the purple thing and then it comes up and then it does the ABC yellow ball with the logo around. Yeah, because that was on the front of my Inspector Gadget VHS back in the day. So every time I hear Inspector Gadget theme go, I always hear the dun 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 dun.
A post on Facebook the other day just saying how whenever they saw come and get it, that would always be just before Inspector Gadget went on. That was like the memory.
Although to be fair, you know, you could only get away with pointing out the hypocrisy of product placement on a platform like the ABC. You're never going to hear anybody say, you know, who said you can't advertise on Channel 9? Nobody.
What they could have done, I suppose, is they could have created like a fake hardware shop brand and a fake car brand and all this, and they could have, you know, but it probably wouldn't have been as funny if they'd used fake brands. So you've got to use the real brands or it doesn't work.
To join a parallel, it's like when they got real people in for that Australian Constitution sketch with, you know, people, the citizenship sketch, rather.
Oh,
the Late Show.
It could have been the regular cast dressing up as foreigners, but it wouldn't have been as funny,
No.
They could have also used a defunct hardware company like Knockin' Kirby's or something like that, because at least it'll be brand aware, but it's not active. So you know that's going to fail.
Yeah.
Which leads into this next part, because after it gets back.
Yes, the big punchline, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the punchline, because Mike's back from his skiing weekend still wearing his clothing. Like, he's had all that time, unless he's come directly from the snowfields, looking a bit wind-chilled. He managed to get out of the charity gig after he got Dom to call Jeff to say that Mike's mother was sick up at the snow. Heartless bastard. And Phelpsy ended up hosting the event after all. But the special was well received, but with a drawback, like a really bad drawback.
We had a few hiccups with the playground.
What?
Swing broke on the weekend. Kid was hurt.
Oh, no.
Worse, wasn't your niece?
Well, that's not our fault. I mean, that's the builder.
Which brings us to the second point. Where did you find the builder's name?
Emma's desk.
Marty and Emma were organising an expose on a dodgy builder. That's the name you found.
Well, the desk was messy, Sam.
Thanks to you, we ended up hiring an unregistered, incompetent, bankrupt builder that's wanted in 3 states.
Shit. Anything else?
Only the fact that we've been contacted by the Wilderness Society. Little upset about our use of rainforest timber.
Now, here's the thing. I have not really seen this episode in a long time, probably when it first was broadcast, and that actually stumped me. That shocked me at the end. So it got a real reaction going, oh, shit, where are they going to go with this? Until the survey came in and they rated a 32.
And then they decide, we'll do another one.
Yeah.
So this episode got a review in the Sydney Morning Herald Guide from Tony Squires, basically outlining that many will remember the tattooed gnome Angry Anderson defying his name to build a playground for special children in his first challenge featured on A Current Affair. Many will remember because... They will, yeah. Many will remember because many watched, sending the ratings through the hastily constructed roof. That, of course, wasn't the object of the exercise. Or was it? We cried at the slow-motion bits of kids in hard hats wandering around with boofy workers as the hero lies in you lyric, or its equivalent, warbled from our screens. We marvelled at the fact that Angry had managed to convince people who usually can't give you a quote within 6 weeks to do the work in such a short time. And only the most cynical thought dark thoughts. Only the most friendless of us thought we heard Angry saying things like, "You blokes from Diddley Do Constructions of City Road City, telephone 1234, open 9 to 5 weekdays and most weekends, are the salt of the earth for doing this for free." The challenge was incredibly manipulative, but it achieved a terrific objective and was entertaining, dare we say, worthy television. But it's the word manipulative that seems to have captured the creators of Frontline. It's been the weekly goal of this brilliant show to reveal the other forces at work that conspire to produce the nightly blancmange that somehow shapes our opinions and emotions. Though the challenge may be a soft target, tonight's episode, in which John English is conscripted to do a carbon copy for Frontline, is not a nasty attack, but a clever piece of observation. What do you think about that? Do you think it was nasty, or...
I don't think it was nasty.
Just putting questions out there, as it were.
It's absolutely legitimate to question what they're doing. You know, it clearly didn't stop them as well because, you know, they were doing it, you know, until at least 1998, probably longer than that. It's fine.
The fact that it's the joke is playing the joke on the contrivance of it opposed to the goal of it.
Yeah.
And the goal of it is, as I say, because they say, as Sam says, everybody wins. And you go, well, okay, we can accept the ending of it because everybody wins out. But yeah, the joke is, you know, when John English is trying to use the phone and it rings suddenly, you know, that the joke is the contrivance rather than the goal.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, also, there's an interesting postscript as well, which comes from the review the following week from Robin Oliver in the Sydney Morning Herald Guide. This patchwork program was absolutely spot on last week when, in a nice piece of timing, it sent up a current affair and those ratings chasing Nobody Can Fault Us for the Good Works We Perform challenge thingamies with Angry Anderson. 4 days after Frontline, Anderson enlisted 10,000 schoolchildren to plant 1 million trees along the banks of the Murray. And it was good work. But it made us wonder where the supposed current affairs went to that day. Perhaps there were none.
Wow.
So how about that?
Those trees planted themselves.
So the actual scam of it is, you know, they can get really good ratings and they don't have to make so many stories.
Well, that and also, yeah, I'm amazed that basically Frontline Monday, the thing that Frontline is parodying on Friday, same week.
Yeah.
What was the turnover between the siege on Current Affair and the siege of Frontline? Because I imagine that would be quite close together.
It was about a year between the two things happening.
So similar to when Angry did the special in this episode, about a year.
Well, the siege episode, that's what kind of inspired for them to create Frontline. So, and then, of course, that was all happening and they've gone, oh, I think we should, you know, take the mickey out of Current Affairs in general. So it was like that first step up. And when I don't have it right now, but there's a part of, yes, Jane Kennedy actually talks about it in, I think, when she pops up in Hey Hey It's Saturday, and she is talking about the turnaround time to create an episode, and it's only a couple of weeks, so they'll be filming one thing in June or May, June, and then it'll be on air around August. That's why some of the episodes, when we look back at the news or whatever at the time, some of it is pretty close or pretty relevant to that moment when it went to air.
And now also, specifically to what you were talking about, Dom, about the siege, I'm pretty sure there was a reference to the siege in the second season of The Late Show. I reckon it might have even been connected to a John Blackman gag, I think.
Yeah. Was it Mick and Tone referenced it, didn't they?
Oh, I think it might have been News Desk.
Or possibly News Desk. Yeah, I can't remember.
It would have been News Desk, yeah.
But, yeah.
It was News Desk did the Blackmaning, didn't he?
Yeah. Thank goodness that Working Dog took their time, between the Kangai siege happening and the siege episode, to sort of make their thoughts a bit more sharper, I think.
All right, well, that concludes Frontline Season 2, Episode 6, and the Champagne Comedy Podcast, Episode 59.
Yeah. Wow. And we can burn our script books now.
Yeah, so
you can send one to me because I still don't have a copy.
Okay. Yeah. Daniel, send it to Kim then.
Yeah, okay? I'm happy to have it.
I can't believe you haven't found one, Kim. There must be some second hand.
I haven't been looking. I looked when we first mentioned it, but I haven't looked since. So maybe there's one on eBay.
Yeah.
I'll have a look.
Well, actually, speaking of op shop buys, I found Eat Your Peas by Martin Molloy, and I flipped next disc, and it was Tin Man, 18 Strings. Is that what the song
yes,
was?
Yes, the theme song.
It was the next disc in the pile. So I grabbed them both. Wow. And went, that's fate. It was meant to be.
The theme song to Martin Molloy, which everybody thinks that it samples Smells Like Teen Spirit, but it actually doesn't.
It doesn't, no.
It's just, it sort of sounds a bit sound-alike, but yeah. They did do a remastered version recently, which does replace the original riff with a Smells Like Teen Spirit riff. So you can actually buy that version online now.
My brother gave me the Third Degree when I said, "Oh, it samples Nirvana." He goes, "No, it doesn't." And he's a musician, so he goes, "No, this is what the Nirvana riff sounds like." And then he did it on his guitar. He goes, "This is what the 18 strings Tin Man is." And I went, "Oh, shit."
Yeah, it's something. The original is something like na 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 na, and it's the other one. It just goes straight up in 18 strings. I don't know why I'm talking about this anymore when we're trying to wrap the show up.
Yeah, let's wrap the show up. Yeah.
So email us champagnelateshow@gmail.com. Check our episode show notes for our socials and also search on Facebook Champagne Comedy Podcast Group. Also buymeacoffee.com/TLS Champagne Pod if you think we're worth a dollar. And also a big thank you to you, Dom, for coming on, and we'll definitely have you back on again if you dare to put up with us.
Yeah, absolutely. Sounds great.
Have you got anything to plug, basically?
I encourage everyone to start enjoying mid-90s cricket by subscribing to @CupMutual on Twitter or X. And please subscribe to What I Find on VHS on YouTube. That's one word. That is where an inordinate number of very boring commercials sit, and I'm sure one of them will tickle your nostalgic fancy.
Mate, you're a legend.
Yeah.
Thank you for keeping the dream alive. So, all right. Thank you, as always, to Alison, Daniel, and Kim.
Yeah.
And you, the listener. I'm Matt. Thanks for listening. Catch you next episode. Bye.
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 Thank you for listening to the Champagne Comedy Podcast, created by fans for the fans. For more information on this podcast, please visit champagnecomedy.com. Produced by Matt Fulton Productions. MattFulton.com.au.
That's fun.
Ha ha ha!